Welcome to the Effin' Rad Snowboarding Podcast. I'm Eric Trollson.
Wow, this is a great way to climb mountains and come down, you know.
For our reception, our Vulcan buddies brought acid.
I was dropping in and snaking people and causing shit. I remember calling on the radio, and I'm like, Brushy, where are you? You know,
Greg would do the tricks. He was kind of like the Tony Hawk of snowboarding.
I mean, people just really gravitated to the backcountry.
I liked Greg, but he didn't really care for me too much because I was a little shithead.
Our guest this week is Tarquin Robbins, who helped usher in the fat pants and wide stance era of snowboarding. He came from a skateboard punk background and was involved in an incident in the Las Vegas trade show where he had a gun in the show and was arrested by police. His reputation for being a badass is huge, so I was surprised to find out how nice of a guy he was.
Hello, Tarquin speaking. My background and history is so exceptionally bizarre. It's born in South Africa, grew up in America, so I went to high school, went to university, and my whole snowboard career was in the States. My family's half English, my dad's English.
Yeah.
And when I retired from snowboarding, I just ended up settling back here in the UK, which I'd never lived in, never thought I'd ever live here, and just one thing led to another, and 13 years later, I'm still here.
So what was your first snowboard? What was the first board you rode?
Very first board I actually rode was a black snow edge, plastic base, plastic guys. I'd driven from Florida to Loveland ski area, rented black snows, learned to snowboard in a pair of jeans, Doc Martens, no gloves, in powder conditions at Loveland ski area. Got back in my truck, drove all the way back to Florida, was also in high school, and moved out a couple of weeks later. First board I bought right after that was a Barfoot Twin Tip. 151. I wish I'd kept that board. You know, I mean, that's one of my regrets is all the stuff I had, all the boards that I went through, and, you know, so many unique boards I just gave away. And that one being the first one, so the Twin Tip 151, the Barfoot was my first one I bought. I bought it from Colorado Ski and Golf in Boulder. Then I bought a Kemper 155, you know, the really iconic.
Yeah, the white one, yeah.
Yeah, that was my second board. Then I got given a Burton Craig Kelly from the Burton guys. The guise of becoming a Burton kid, but that wasn't me. I was very anti some of the way things were going, and that was right from the early days. And, you know, I love my skating. Coming from Florida to the mountains, surfing and skating were sort of the important things for me, and riding bikes, ironically, because I was really into, you know, riding bikes as well, so BMX, and both freestyle and jumping. And in the 80s, I'd seen the skaters I looked up to, like Steve Caballero and you know, guys like Rob Roskopf and stuff. And there was a cover of Thrasher, 1988, and I saw them, and that was it. It was like, yep, I need to go find where this is going on. And before I'd actually moved out to Colorado, I'd actually gone up to like some places in North Carolina and just sort of tried stuff, but like nothing like the first proper, you know, the first foray in the Loveland ski area. So, yeah, for me, I mean, I was a punk rock kid and into skating, and the idea of snowboarding, I wanted to skate on snow. That was what I wanted. And it was, there were the badasses in the sport already, you know, Sean Palmer and guys like that, and they already had that going, but they were still day glowish, and the images were still a bit fucked up, so it needed a new school element. The guys I was riding with, all that whole crew of guys that was helping introduce that, I mean, it was all the H Street videos, Matt Hensley and all that kind of stuff that was influencing us. So, I mean, that's all it was, is essentially I just wanted to, you know, do what I couldn't do on a skateboard, on a snowboard. That's the way I looked at it. Well, if I, it's hard to do it on a skate, well, let's see if we can do it on a snowboard. And have an element of style. I mean, there was a little bit of style missing, but it was happening everywhere. It wasn't just me. It was like, you know, there were small pockets and crews doing the same thing everywhere else. So it just seemed to go with the change in skating. You know, skateboarding had a big new school element that was coming into play. You know, for a lot of kids that were part of that, it just sort of, it was a natural progression.
I asked Tarquin if he had to T-bolt his boards to get the wide stance.
From the Barfoot stuff, no. Because obviously, you know, that was prior to, that was just getting the basics done. But it was from right after that, so after the Barfoot, my first Kemper, it was like when, you know, when bindings were ripping out. Yeah, I T-bolted that. Craig Kelly, no, but from there on out, the next balls were from Aggression, which was who I rode for. They didn't do a proper hole pattern. It was just T-bolt to get, and then it was just starting to experiment. So then the years through there, it was all about, you know, trying to figure out what worked and what didn't. And for me, that was it. It was just experimenting, trying to figure out, you know. I mean, I went from all extremes. I mean, I rode with no Ibex for starters, but I also went, you know, really big stances and realized that shit was too much. But some of the guys I was riding with up in Steam, but like, you know, 180 boards with, you know, 26, 27-inch stances were, you know, you're just going, this is painful. So you sort of try work on what sort of feels comfortable and good, but you can still kind of tweak and, you know, if you could drop your knee to the board and there's room, that was about as much as... and your ankles didn't snap.
Yeah, that's amazing. So who else were you sponsored by? Were you on Airwalk or some boot sponsor?
One of the first big rides I had was with Airwalk. And well, actually, my very, very first sponsor was Waverave, when Waverave was still a shop, and then they first started doing clothing. Troy and Trent Bush were the main instrumental, which then, when they went from Waverave to Twist, I followed because of that whole... those guys, I mean, that was part of, you know, Justin Hoisnick's Vertical Addictions. The first project I ever did shooting-wise was a calendar with Justin, which was for Vertical Addictions, which was, I think, it was one of the first snowboard projects he ever did. And I was actually on the camper, but the picture that was in the calendar then got run, because you couldn't see the board properly, got run as a big centerpiece for Aggression. First photo shoot I ever did properly was with Justin, and the image, I don't have a copy of it. It was a really cool Tuckney wearing really bright, garish Waverave pants. I had dreads, but they were dyed red, but I'd been out for a surf trip, so they were bleached, they were pink, and they were tied in like a bun on the top of my head, so they looked really fucked up. And this was like just a really, I mean, the Tuckney was one of my favourite shots I think I've ever had, and I knew it was a proper, you know, skate Tuckney, you know, board pulled back behind your back, and or like a pop tart if you think of a vert trick, or, you know, doing it there. So that was one of my favourites, and they had that on the display for the first Aggression trade show, which then became the desk, you know, the desktop. My ugly face and my fucked up hair and bright Waverave clothes.
Tarquin wrote for Waverave outerwear and subsequently for Twist, which I remember as one of the best designed technical outerwear companies of that time.
Twist was one of the first brands that actually tried to change things a little bit and pull in from other directions. Waverave was Waverave, but it was Waverave. It was surf culture influenced. It was, you know, the Twist stuff was, I mean, both Troy and Trent were, their whole careers, I mean, if you look at everything they've done, pretty groundbreaking and substantial, and have had such an impact of, they were doing stuff for Burton down the line later on, and they've had other projects that have been monumental, you know, from being behind Tech 9 to Section to... I mean, even Trent's still now with, you know, Nightmare Developments in Colorado, you know, and still supporting and being behind, like, really core brands that are really anti-establishment and not following the norm. You know, to be 25 years plus in the game and still supporting that stuff is pretty cool. You don't see that much.
We discussed the snowboard industry's lull in sales and how it seems a natural part of snowboarding's progression.
Absolutely. I mean, it goes around in circles. All the sports do. Skating does. I mean, skating's gone through rebirths and deaths, and snowboarding has through as well. It's cool to see the urban scene has had a couple of rebirths and sort of changes. No, I'll never take anything away from them. I mean, people forget that without the corporate side, it's not necessarily selling out. You can't have one without the other. It doesn't work, you know. I mean, you know, we all want to be punk rock and pretend we're the grungiest, you know, the most extreme and alternative out there, but without people actually paying for it, you don't get to do it, you know. Or you either have to have a normal job, work your butt off, and then you can, then snowboarding is fun for you, but that's it. Yeah, I was going to say, the irony of my stuff in the beginning, I don't know if you remember, you know, when my shotgun board came out, and the advert for that with a tutu, you know, that was literally taking the piss of, you know, 90% of snowboarders that were out there. Like, if you're a snowboarder and you're a pro snowboarder specifically, your parents had money because you were in the resorts. You can't live in a resort without having some form of cash. It just didn't work. You know, a lot of kids, even though they try to play it off that they were broke ass coming straight out of nowhere, you know, it was, a lot of it was fake. So, you know, that whole, you know, gangster image and the whole, it's like, come on, you've got, you know, middle class kids that have moved to, you know, in the resorts have come up and trying to, you know, pretend they're from an urban ghetto, that it was, you know, skating, yes. I mean, you can be a down and out kid and living in the streets and just skate and just have a board, and you don't need money to be a skater. You just, as long as you've just got a board and you, that can last for enough time, yeah, that's it, that's all you need. You know, the big monies came in, and my generation, the first generation of pros that started, I mean, I got lucky, I got paid really well to do nothing, you know, 5 years, 6 years worth of the glory days where, yeah, I got, you know, got to fuck about and not really film and not really do stuff and, you know, get to have a good life, live in the mountains and just shred all day long.
Tarquin rode with pretty much every pro you can imagine from the late 80s and early 90s.
The early guys were like Steve Blakely, a guy named Rich Whitlock, and then all like the Wastels, Stevie Alters, all the Tech 9 guys, well, Ethan Fortier, Cole Taylor, there's Adam Merriman, who's from the early generation of late 80s, and he was the Dayglow kid, the guy that would have been the superstar, that kind of stuff. Adam's a rad guy. J2, so J3, God, and then Quinn Sandoval, guys that are still in the industry, actually, so guys like George Kleckner, Jorge from Union, those part of the Steamboat crew, Clay Pitcher from Wolf Creek Mountain was a Steamboat kid, Keith Wilson, who works for Independent, was a Steamboat kid from there. I've got tons of guys from that side of it, you know, guys like Cody Dresser. Cody and I rode a lot together, and then guys that have moved to Utah, so like Blue Montgomery, Brian Thien, Jason Bump, as again, riding with everybody, like like, you know, Matt Hood, you know, guys like Dale Rayberg, Russell Winfield, all the original Joyride guys, Nate Cole, Ron Rogers. Guys, yeah, it's just endless amounts. Everybody rode with everybody when you got a chance to. Mikey LeBlanc, so Mikey from Colorado when he was in Colorado, then when he was in Utah. Mikey and I were on Division 23 together at the back end of my career, so one of my favorite riders of all time. Yeah, the list is endless. So, you know, guys like, you know, Matt and Temple Cummings, you know, all those guys from Pacific Northwest, and Jamie Lynn and Don Zabo and Ranquit. Ranquit and I never really, like, I wouldn't say we never got on, but we didn't not get on. I think we both had similar sort of way about us, individualistic and not really, you know, not really wanting to follow or do anything that anybody else wants to do. I've always respected him for that side of it. You know, he never gave a fuck about anybody else's shit. He was a bit more of a name than I ever was. But then, you know, I chose not to be, and I don't think he chose to be anyway. Just, you know, and as I said, I've always dug his riding.
Yeah.
And his personality has always been one of my favorites as far as, you know, he's been a unique character. Even now, like, seeing with the D-Day stuff is really cool.
Yeah.
And Roach and those guys. So,
you know, he rides, you know, no highback still, hey?
Yeah, absolutely. And both of us rode, I mean, I rode no highbacks for most of my side of things. It wasn't until the later days of my career that I put highbacks back on, and not just for a change. I always found, and I still find today, I mean, I don't ride no highbacks much, but I still find it's a nice sloppy, loose feeling. And I like sloppy. I always like loose boots. And the big shit now, you can't deal with it. And it's really tough to go, but I don't do that shit anymore, so I'm not thrust on it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mentioned to Tarquin that Damian Sanders seems to hate that he was wearing all that fluorescent gear and neon stuff, but that I didn't really notice it wasn't cool at that time.
I hated that image, but man, Damian and Dana and those guys were just fucking nutcases. And you could never take that away from them. He was a groundbreaker in his own right by every stretch of the imagination. One of my favorite movies of all time was The Western Front. Pre all of this stuff, I watched that back over and over and over. And I can still see it in my mind after all these years. Still one of my favorites of all time. And, you know, the Burton movies were crap. And sort of not being an industrial kid, but I was a punk rock. I came from a hardcore punk rock scene as a skater. So music-wise, there was a lot of stuff in there that was so anti what everything else was. So a lot of people don't recognize it, but, you know, I think there's a big core set of people that sort of look to that and go, yeah, hang on a second, that changed a lot of stuff.
Snowboarding being in the Olympics has been a recurring theme here at the podcast. Tarquin, as you can probably guess, was not crazy about it.
You know, I'm not a big fan of, you know, the Olympics and that side of it. We have a couple of British riders that, you know, that are very dedicated on the Olympic side, just like in America and Canada. And they don't give a shit about the history and the culture, and they learn tricks because this is the way to do it. And that's fine, you know, that's what snowboarding is to them. It's not me, and it never will be me, and, you know, I don't believe in it, but it's still snowboarding, and it's what they want to do, and that's cool. I've never been into, you know, organized competitions, never have, never will, because I believe that, you know, you can't effectively judge those type of events because everybody's got a different take on it.
If you've heard any other episodes of this show, then you probably can guess who I'm going to ask about next. Craig Kelly was the world champ when Tarquin was coming up as an AM.
Did your opinion of him change when he went into the backcountry? Was that something you noticed, or was that not?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't say I was a Craig Kelly fan, but I've always had admiration and respect for him. My first encounter with him was actually me being an asshole punk at a PSTA contest in Arapahoe Basin. I was an unknown twat, and myself and a couple of who then became future Lamar riders, Gilligan Yoda and a guy named Butsy Barney, we were dropping in on Palmer and Kelly during their contest runs and slashing people. And I remember quite vividly, I wore a white sweatshirt that I'd screen printed like this, just fucked up shit all over it, and was, you know, looking like, you know, wearing really fucked up shit pants, and I was dropping in and snaking people and causing shit. And so I got to the bottom of this mini ditch pipe after I'd cut, I don't know who I cut up. Kelly threw a snowball at me, like back of my head. I turned around and flipped him off. I was like, fuck you. And he just smiled, and I just gave him a thumbs up and walked up again and dropped in on somebody else kind of scenario. So he could have been a dick about it because, you know, I was there being an asshole myself, and, you know, I didn't have a pro model yet. No one knew who the fuck I was, sort of. And it was just like, it wasn't like, you know, they were upset that I was being a cock. It was kind of like, yeah, this is what snowboarding is, and that was fine. And, you know, Kelly was cool with it. He wasn't like, you little shit, you know, fucking grow up. Everybody wanted to ride, and everybody wanted to better themselves, and everybody understood that contests were run by people that didn't give a fuck about snowboarding, but there was no one else doing it, so what are you going to do?
We started talking about how epic Baldface looks. Baldface Lodge is located across Kootenai Lake from Nelson, B.C., and is a heli in cat ski operation that Teton Gravity Research, some Jackson Hole hardcores, called the Temple of Snowboarding. Started by Jeff Pensiero with the help of Craig Kelly and Dave Grohl, Baldface looks like unbelievable, amazing terrain. The Vintage Snowboard Traders group on Facebook has an annual get-together every December at Baldface with surprise guest pros.
I've got an invite from Jeff because he's got a few of my boards up in Baldface, so I was hoping to come out this year for the VST, for the Vintage Snowboard Trader thing, but if I can get away, I couldn't get away this year. It's just too much work to get done. But I mentioned in the beginning, one of my biggest regrets is not hanging on to a lot of stuff, and there's so much stuff that, you know, I look back at now. I got one of the first Santa Cruz Tahoes from Joel Gomez from Sessions, never kept it. You know, I got first 8 Streets from Tony Magnuson when I rode for 8 Street before all of that. So there were a whole bunch of 8 Streets that I would kill if I had them that were before Evol started that Tony was making. Like really cool ones that I fucking, I'll never see again. All my own pro models, I never kept any of my own stuff. And I've spent the last 7 years now, and again, partly with the VST guys, tracking down stuff and built back up some of my old boards because of them. I started a company with the solid manufacturing guys after I left Evol, which was a company called Future, and the boards were really personal to me because of my dad. There's a pro model that I had with him on it that I've yet to find, so it's one of the ones I'm still trying to... But it was such a small entity that we did, and then it went dead while I was actually out on tour with the team. And there's a set of boards there that I'm definitely missing, but they'll be hard to find. I've managed to find one Future board out there, and I've got it. I've got two, sorry. But it's not my own one, not my pro model, so there were two models that I'm still after. So, if you see any Future boards from the late 90s, yeah, the boards were awesome. And I left Evol because, you know, as much as I dig Tony and he was super cool to ride for, the companies that he used to make the boards were shit. He just used shit manufacturing and he refused to change. And the boards sucked to ride. They always sucked. They were heavy. They were nasty. They were fucking... And I couldn't take it anymore. And I wanted to ride something that actually rode properly. And my input was going somewhere, not just pick a graphic and they stick it on a board and it goes to the shops and it's kids paid and it rides like shit. For one, it's not going to be like skating. The two most important things for me out of that were getting to ride for Airwalk. Was like, as a skater at the time when Airwalk was still a fairly sizable company, you know, and a really big brand for skating, was like, yes. And then the next one from the Tony Magnuson riding for 8 Street and Evol was the other one. Again, one of my biggest influences was Shackle Me Not and 8 Street videos, Matt Hensley and that stuff, because that changed the whole skate world. And it's what I believe for me changed snowboarding. You know, when I came into it, there was no history, proper history, and I was very anti what it was already there. And I made a point of trying to get away from what was already happening. So I didn't have a history, but having a history to go with is important. And the skating and surfing have always had that. They've always had that to look back on and sort of remember and move forward. And snowboarding, it's taken a long time for snowboarding too, suddenly. I mean, 10 years of me being retired from riding, no one gives a fuck. And then all of a sudden it was like, well, hang on a second. There was a big influential change in the 90s, late 80s and early 90s, and things moved quite dramatically. And it's cool to see that people acknowledge, and then next generations from there can sort of kind of follow through, and it'll keep it moving forward.
The state of snowboarding today could not be imagined 20 years ago. Tarquin reminded me that getting kicked off a ski hill was routine procedure back in the day.
Yeah, building stuff was a fucking no-no. And when we started, I mean, the whole taking skateboarding to snow, when you're ollieing picnic tables and jumping ropes and stuff and fences, you were getting, ski patrol were kicking your ass and dragging you off the mountain and, you know, pulling passes and tickets left, right, and center for it.
It really was such a shock to go to Mount Hood in the early 90s.
No, totally. I mean, I remember my first trips up there, and Kurt Hine was, you know, the early stuff that he was building, you know, it was like, fuck me, you know. You know, why can't we have this anywhere else? You know, you've got these, like, these cool fucking sliders and boxes and stuff, and, you know, it didn't exist anywhere else, you know. Big Bear started early days, you know.
Yep.
But it was like Big Bear or... you know, Mount Hood, so, you know, and that was it, you know, nowhere else.
So do you still snowboard today?
Yeah, absolutely. This summer is actually probably the least amount I've done in a bit. I'm fortunate enough that I have a snow dome here in London, a half hour from my work. In fact, I'll be there on Friday night for the first time this summer, actually, for a snowboard shop called Route 1, where they're up there at Signature Park. I'll be going out with all the guys up there. I've been working and riding as an ambassador for Capita Union and quite a few other brands here in the UK for a good number of years, so I usually do a couple trips a year, A, with my missus to just have fun, but also just to still, you know, ride and hang out with guys. And the UK snowboard industry is quite small, so it's pretty powerful. So yeah, I've got my fingers in here, and it's the enjoyment side of it. I can do what I want, you know, don't have to listen to anybody else. And snowboarding still is and always will be an enjoyable thing for me. I got burnt out massively when I retired. I literally woke up and said, you know what, I don't want to fucking see anybody, snow, anything like that, anybody to do with the industry, and literally just sold up and fucked off and went and sat on the beach for a while and just didn't want to be anywhere near it. It took a long time to sort of kind of want to be around it. And then years later, my dad started snowboarding with me when I was, you know, when I was young. He died in a snowboard accident in 2005, so I'd been riding with him a month before, and it's just unfortunate in Verbier, you know, he went off piste and didn't come back. So I sort of that kind of put a bit of a step aside again from it, and it wasn't until about 2011 I got an invite to Capita Premier, and I was like, you know what, I've not ridden in a bit, and the guys were like, well, dude, you know, come and ride with us, and I was full on back into just having fun since then. My dad was like one of my best mates, you know, a good friend. He's always encouraged me. I mean, he was the one that encouraged me to do all of it right from the start. It was good to surf with, skated with, and he was, you know, he was there right from the start for snowboarding. He started the same time I did, and he was there to and enjoyed it. So he was experienced, and it, for me to be able to, if I took that away from him, saying, well, you know, why did he have to, then it would deny all of us that right and privilege to be able to go explore and do it without right. consequence. We all know that there is a consequence, and he knew it just as much as I do. So from that point of view, you know, I'm happy, not sad, because, you know, without it, I wouldn't be doing what I would have done, and I wouldn't still be able to enjoy my life. So, you know, yeah, I'm upset that it happens, but I'm not upset because I could never say to my kids, or, you know, look, don't do it because these are the consequences. If you know, there's a right and wrong way to do it, but learn. And he knew the right stuff. It just was one of those things. It was unfortunate. And that just shows you that it does happen. It can happen. No matter how much, you know, you look after yourself and you try, things can go wrong. As long as you are aware of it and accept the consequences, then you get to enjoy your life. So he enjoyed his life, and that's it. That's the bottom line. So, yeah, it's not a bad thing. It's, you know, sucks, but it's, at the end of the day, at least it enables me to still continue to enjoy myself without, you know, I take responsibility for myself. If I'm going to do anything, you know, above and beyond, make sure I've, you know, I know what I'm doing, and if I don't, pay the price.
It must be unbelievably hard to lose your dad to something that you love, like snowboarding. Sounds like Tarquin's got it kind of figured out, though, huh? I really want to thank him for being our guest this week. It was incredible to talk to him. I had a blast.
Thanks, Tarquin.
All right, dude. Cheers for that.
See ya.
All right, bye. Bye.
Thanks for downloading the show and listening right to the end. Come back next week for another episode of the F and Rad Snowboarding Podcast, brought to you by BR Productions.